Good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press conference today, 13 February. We have a very important agenda for you today. We have Afghanistan, we have the situation in Cuba, we have Cyclone Gezani Madagascar update, and we have a colleague from UNICEF who'll join us to speak about South Sudan. So without further ado, I'm going to turn to you, Barbar. Maybe you can introduce your guest from HCR in Afghanistan.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning and a happy sunny Friday all. Today, we are joined by my colleague Arafat Jamal. He's a known name to you, a UNHCR representative in Afghanistan from Kabul to update on the evolving humanitarian situation. He has been helping to keep you updated all through last year on Afghanistan. One may think as a country it has seen all in terms of humanitarian situations, but last year added one more to the growing list of challenges with unprecedented mass returns from the neighboring countries. Before passing on the mic to Arafat Jamal, he's happy to answer questions in French too. Over to you, Arafat Jamal.
Thank you so much, Babarjan and colleagues, and it's good to be with you again, speaking from a foggy and wintry Kabul today. The main news that I would like to convey today is the sheer number of returns that have occurred in Afghanistan to date. Since October 2023, we have seen 5.4 million people return to Afghanistan. Last year alone, we saw 2.9 million people, and this year we have already witnessed the return of 150,000 Afghans, largely from Iran and Pakistan. I would like to note and underline that the number of returns in 2025, 2.9 million, is officially the largest number of returns that we have witnessed to any single country. This is massive. And the speed and scale of these returns has pushed Afghanistan nearly to the brink. I would underline that this is a country that welcomes its people for the most part, and to which people are attached. At the same time, the massive demographic shock of this number of people, which is around 12% of the population, is pushing us to the brink over here. The country is already facing a large humanitarian and human rights situation, particularly as concerns women and girls. It has a fragile economy, and it is a place of recurring natural disasters and drought. According to a recent World Bank report, the rapid population growth fueled by the returns is expected to lead to a 4% decline in GDP per capita. This is a statistic that in some way comes upon another potentially brighter statistic, which is that the economy would have grown normally, but for the large number of returns. This high number of returns this year is particularly concerning given the severity of winter with freezing temperatures and heavy snowfall across much of the country. This situation is compounded by blockages at the frontier, which are preventing the normal trade supplies, including pharmaceutical supplies, from entering Afghanistan. A recent survey of returnees highlights the scale of challenges faced. Of those that we have spoken to, just over half reported being able to find some form of work, even if informal. For women, this figure drops to less than a quarter. More than half of returnee families report having no civil documentation, for example, identity cards to prove who they are or where they are from, and more than 90% are living on less than $5 per day. We are deeply concerned about the sustainability of these returns. While 5% of returnees say they intend to leave Afghanistan again, this figure is slightly belied by the fact that more than 10% seem to know a relative or a community who has already left the country again. And these decisions, I would underscore, to undertake dangerous journeys are not driven by a lack of a desire to remain in the country, on the contrary, but the reality that many are unable to rebuild their viable and dignified lives. And this is something that I do notice as I travel around the country, that when a person enters Afghanistan, they're willing to make a go of it. But 9 months on, they are already considering leaving simply because of a lack of options in this country. There are nonetheless pockets of hope. We have seen that the socioeconomic profile of returnees is evolving, with those who returned in 2025 generally having higher education levels and stronger links to local markets. With sustainable livelihood opportunities, returnees can leverage their skills and experience to contribute to Afghanistan's economic recovery and stabilization. For UNHCR, we are focusing on the reintegration of returnees this year. We have access, presence, and experience built up over four decades of working in Afghanistan to deliver assistance that communities themselves say they need most. And this is focusing largely on protection, including cash safety nets, on housing, and on jobs. And our particular focus has always been the women of Afghanistan. Together with other UN agencies and our partners, we are closely monitoring the situation across the region. We remain prepared to respond to population movements into Afghanistan, while also continuing to call on neighboring countries to protect and assist Afghan refugees. Yet, we remain deeply concerned by the dramatically shrinking asylum climate in the sub-region. And this is of particular concern as we note geopolitical instability that is prevalent throughout the area. With this dire humanitarian situation and rapidly increasing population, additional support is urgently needed in 2026 to scale up assistance and to invest in the reintegration efforts that allow people to rebuild their lives with dignity and with hope. For 2026, UNHCR needs at least US$216 million to support displaced people and returnees across Afghanistan. To date, we are only 8% funded. So, dear colleagues, I would just like to end by again noting that the phenomenon of returns is massive. Last year, the largest number of returns to any country in the world. That these returns are coming into a country that is deeply precarious, that is welcoming of these people, but is very ill-equipped to receive them. If we want to turn return into a focus for stability, for economic growth, and for coexistence, we need to invest in the families, in the women, and in these people who are returning. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jamal, for this immensely important update on this dire situation. Okay, we'll take questions starting in the room. We have AFP.
Oui, bonjour, Agnès Pedrero, Agence France-Presse. Du coup, je vais poser la question en français, puisqu'on peut poser la question en français, concernant le blocage des médicaments aux frontières que vous avez évoqué. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous en dire plus, nous dire depuis quand est-ce que ces blocages ont été mis
à... Je ne sais pas, oui.
You haven't listened anything? Again?
From the beginning.
Ah, OK.
Si, vous... c'était coupé, oui.
Oui, donc
allez-y seulement.
Agnès Pedrero, Agence France-Presse, concernant le blocage des médicaments que vous avez évoqués, est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire depuis quand est-ce qu'ils ont été mis en place, pour quelles raisons, comment est-ce que ça affecte les populations, et est-ce que ça concerne aussi l'aide humanitaire, enfin les médicaments apportés par l'ONU? Merci.
Allez-y, s'il vous plaît.
Merci pour votre question. Je pense que ça fait déjà 4 ou 5 mois, je ne suis pas exactement sûr, qu'il y a eu le blocage entre le Pakistan et l'Afghanistan. Et ça affecte tout ce qu'il y a entre les deux pays. Donc déjà le commerce normal, ce qui affecte toujours le secteur agricole. Ici en Afghanistan, il y a normalement Il y a l'exportation des légumes et des fruits vers le Pakistan. Actuellement, on peut trouver dans le marché, par exemple, des choux-fleurs à 20 centimes le chou-fleur parce qu'il n'y a plus de marché au Pakistan. Mais à part ça, il y a aussi des médicaments et des autres vivres pour l'assistance humanitaire. Si je me rappelle bien, parmi les Nations Unies, surtout le UNICEF, le OMS et le HCR, on a eu pas mal de vivres, de pharmaceutiques, d'autres choses qui ont été bloquées et qui demeurent toujours au Pakistan.
Merci beaucoup. La prochaine, next question. You have a follow-up. Go ahead.
Yes, I don't know if WHO is online. Maybe they could. I don't know if WHO. L'OMS, WHO is online. Maybe they could have an update on that.
OMS, yes, Christian is connected, in fact, yes. Christian, do you want to jump in?
I have nothing to add at this point, sorry.
Okay, fair enough. We'll take a question now for you from Emma Farge of Reuters.
I wanted to know, in the case of those returning this year, where are they from and are the returns voluntary? Could you also describe the conditions that the returnees are living in Afghanistan? And how many more do you think could come this year? Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Emma, for the question. So it's 150,000 this year alone, and the year is still young. The majority of them are coming in from Pakistan, although there are also Afghans coming in from Iran. The returns are, to a large extent, from Pakistan. There's something called the illegal foreigners repatriation plan, which is continuing, and this is a involuntary return of Afghans. Likewise in Iran. We are appealing to all the countries to ensure that those categories who are at risk in Afghanistan are not sent back. And these would include, on the first instance, women, but also there are other categories, former members of the former government, social activists, musicians, athletes. And there is a list, and we have provided those lists to both countries and have urged them to exercise extreme caution when dealing with such categories. The conditions on the ground are tough. I think that what's happened is that the traditional fabric and the traditional safety nets that have been able to receive Afghans have been overwhelmed by the sheer number of people returning, and also by changes in the climate in the country. So whereas in the past, people from rural areas may be able to go to a village and basically at least manage to subsistence farm, nowadays the lack of water in those areas means that form of survival is no longer available. Likewise, people or more urban people are basically conglomerating in the outskirts of cities and essentially forming informal settlements where they are trying to engage in day labor.
Thank you. I think Emma has a follow-up for you.
I'd love to see the list of categories, if that's possible, as a follow-up. But just could you say a word on whether globally, Iran and Pakistan are respecting those categories that you sent them? Thank you.
So we have an advisory which is publicly available, and I'm sure we can circulate that to any interested people. And of course, we have shared that with both governments. They are very well aware of it, and we do intervene on specific cases. So I think that, to the extent possible, we are in a dialogue with both of them. They have indicated the willingness, and we have also seen that whenever we do intervene, there is generally been a positive response.
Thank you again. We have another question for you from Satoko of Yomiuri Shimbun. Satoko-san.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I would like to know about the funding for 2025. How much did you appeal for 2025, and how much did you actually receive in 2025? As you said, that the year that the country received the largest number of the returnees. Thank you.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And I would kindly request if I can give that to you in writing, just because I don't have the exact figures in my head, but it's an excellent question.
Okay, fair enough. We'll get back to you on that. Babar will get back to you, perhaps. See if there are further questions for you. Yes, Taha.
Thank you. I have a relevant question for UNHCR and WTO, IOM, and High Commissioner for Human Rights, if they are connected. We have been informed that the Sudanese Prime Minister. So we have been informed that the Sudanese Prime Minister visited some UN organizations as WHO, IOM, UNCCR, High Commissioner for Human Rights. So why did this organization conceal the visit from UN accredited journalists? Thank you.
I'm not sure to visit to where exactly. I'm not sure if I understand the question. If you can clarify, please, thank you.
Yes, the Sudanese Prime Minister, Dr. Kamel Idris, visited some organizations, UN organizations, such as High Commissioner for Human Rights, High Commissioner for Refugees, and IOM, I think. And they didn't inform as UN accredited journalist by this visit. This is my question.
Thank you for raising this. I will certainly I will look into this, and maybe my colleagues, if they have anything to add afterwards, maybe we'll connect with you. I'm unaware of this visit, but certainly I appreciate your concern for obviously notifying the media about such a high profile visit. But we'll look into this and get back to you, Taha. Thanks. John, is this on Afghanistan?
No, it's following up to Taha's question.
Yeah, quickly.
Actually, a very practical, logistical answer to this would be to most agencies to follow what the Durajik's office does very well in New York and give us a paragraph readout statement, ideally emailed to us and not posted on social media. Thank you.
Well noted. Thank you, John. I know this is an issue that you have raised before, and has been raised before, I should say, and we do our best to share readouts with you. On behalf of the Secretary General, in fact, we shared three with you in the last few hours. This is a common practice, and we'll certainly keep that up. And should there be any high-level dignitaries coming, such as Sudanese Prime Minister or President, we will definitely make sure we do our best to inform you in advance. So let's move on. I think we have another. Jamie, is this on Afghanistan? Because we have other items on the agenda. Jamie.
Yes, it is about Afghanistan.
Go ahead.
Thank you, sir, for coming to see us. I wanted to just follow up on your initial news item about the large number of returns to Afghanistan. What can we read into that? I mean, you mentioned in your comments that you're concerned about the stability of the returns. You've also said that just over half have reported being able to find some work. I mean, are these people being pressured to return to their home country unwillingly, or are they actually seeing opportunity and hope under the Taliban and leadership there? I mean, has the narrative been international narrative been unfair about the real conditions in Afghanistan, that in fact all these people are returning because they hope to build better lives there? Or is it are we missing some other narrative there? If you could just kind of, based on all your travels across the country, if you could just kind of clear up the image there as to what we should read into these returns. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think the first thing to say is no, it's not a narrative of hope, unfortunately. The over 5 million people who have come back have not come back like in other refugee situations of the past, because there's a great resolution to 4 decades of conflict, and they're ready to come home and make a go of it. Rather, it has been a combination of some level of coercion, some level of conditions being made intolerable, and a great deal of exhaustion on the part of the asylum countries. And I'd like to underscore at this point that it has been 4 decades, and it has been 4 decades of incredible generosity on the part of both Pakistan and Iran, where they've, in their time of need, they were there for the Afghans. They opened their borders, they opened their schools, their hospitals, their subsidized fuel, their subsidized food, and Afghans have benefited from that. And UNHCR is immensely grateful to both countries. But at this point, the dynamic has changed, not only in Pakistan and Iran, but we're seeing this further afield, including in Europe, where the protections that had previously been accorded to Afghans are no longer necessarily prevailing. And so people are not coming back in an entirely voluntary manner. Having said that, I would, in my travels around the country and so on, what I do note is that the Afghans are willing to make a go of it. I think they always knew that this is, that they were in asylum, that they were not home. And so to a certain extent, you could say that they're happy to be home, or they are content that they're at home. But what they're really looking for is some means to make a go of it. And that's what's lacking. And the real worry here is that they're coming back. They're willing to try. But if they don't have a choice after a few months, after a year, they are going to bounce back. They are going to bounce back to Iran, to Turkey, to further afield. And I don't think this is in anyone's interest.
Thank you once again. A couple more questions for you. Paula of Geneva Solutions. Paula.
Yes, good morning. So actually, it's just on what you just said now, and you had mentioned in your statement that you got a sense that 9 months onwards, people are considering leaving. Are you actually seeing people leaving? And if so, where? You mentioned Pakistan and Iran. Are people actually trying to leave to other neighboring countries?
So as you can imagine, it's a bit contentious to try to gather information on departures, because many of the departures are undertaken clandestinely. What I can say is that anecdotally, this is what I notice throughout the country, is that when you talk to the people who have gone back, the idea of leaving is very much on their minds as a coping mechanism should they not be able to support their families. And the routes are well traveled. They are often facilitated through different types of agents who will make this travel, and they generally these days are going via Iran rather than Pakistan. But for those who have the means and the ability, they usually, Iran would not necessarily be the first stop. They would keep moving westwards as far as they can get.
Thank you, Emma. Before we go back to you for the final question, perhaps Babar has an update on the figure.
Thank you, dears. Arafajan colleagues have shared last year's figures. So the ask was nearly the same, $260 million, and it was 49% funded, as Arafat Jamal told you. For this year, so far, out of the 216 million, we are at 8%. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Emma, final question.
Thanks for your indulgence. You took the starting point as October 2023. I assume that's when Pakistan changed its policy on repatriations. If you could just clarify why the clock started ticking there for you. And the 5 million that you've counted so far since then, what portion is from Iran and what portion from Pakistan? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. Indeed, you're exactly right. That was when the clock started ticking with the illegal foreigners repatriation plan, and that was that is why we use that figure from October 2023. And in terms of the breakdown between Iran and Pakistan, it's a little bit more from Pakistan than Iran. We will shoot the exact figures to you, which we have, and I should have had them at my fingertips, but I forgot. Sorry.
Yes, no problem, Arafat. Will Babar, I'll get those to you. I lied. There's one more question, Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking that. And apologies, I missed a little bit of your presentation, so I may be asking something you already addressed. But I just wanted to check. Quite a lot of the returnees, I think, went back into the community. So I'm wondering how many are still living in kind of UN camps or reception centers. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Nick. Actually, they are the vast majority are back in their communities. We don't have an encampment policy over here. The camps that you may be thinking of were those that were sort of temporarily set up last year during some of the mass inflows. I mean, at one point we had 70,000 people coming in a single day from Iran. So in those cases, we did set up communal space spots and tents for people, but this was a strictly temporary measure. Otherwise, people go home and they go back to their communities. If they're in some cases when they're unable to be absorbed into their communities or it takes them a little while, there are informal mechanisms, including through religious institutions and others, that do house them in communal structures. But as the international community, we do not have a policy of encampment. We help them in their communities.
Very well noted. Thank you very much, Arafat, for this immensely important briefing. And we'll do our best to get the message out. And, of course, do feel free to connect with us at any point in time. And thank you, Babar, for in advance for the figures as well. So we're going to move on from Afghanistan to Cuba. We have Marta of the UN Human Rights Office, who's going to brief us on the socioeconomic situation in Cuba. Marta.
Good morning, everyone. We are extremely worried about Cuba's deepening socioeconomic crisis amid a decades-long financial trade embargo, extreme weather events, and the recent U.S. measures restricting oil shipments. This is having an increasingly severe impact on the human rights of people in Cuba. Given the dependence of health, food, and water systems on imported fossil fuels, the current oil scarcity has put the availability of essential services at risk nationwide. Intensive care units and emergency rooms are compromised, as are the production, delivery, and storage of vaccines, blood products, and other temperature-sensitive medications. In Cuba, more than 80% of water pumping equipment depends on electricity, and power cuts are undermining access to safer water, sanitation, and hygiene. The fuel shortage has disrupted the rationing system and the regulated basic food basket, and has affected social protection networks, school feeding, maternity homes, and nursing homes, with the most vulnerable groups being disproportionately impacted. The electricity cuts also affect communications and access to information. Access to essential goods and services, including food, water, medicine, and adequate fuel and electricity, should always be safeguarded, as they are fundamental in modern societies to the right to life and the ability to enjoy many other rights. The long-term sustained impact of sectorial sanctions creates economic hardships and weakens the state's capability to fulfill its core responsibilities, including providing protection and assistance services. This increases the risk of fueling social disruption in Cuba. The state, for its part, needs to ensure it is prepared to respond in accordance with international human rights law, being attentive to the needs of the most vulnerable and prioritizing mediation, de-escalation, and the safeguarding of the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and expression for all. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, reiterates his call on all states to lift unilateral sectorial measures given their broad and indiscriminate impact on the population. Policy goals cannot justify actions that in themselves violate human rights. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Marta. We have started in the room. Okay, they'll go online. A couple of questions for you from Jamie, AP.
Hello, Martha. Nice to see you again. Thanks for coming back to see us. I just wanted to, you didn't mention the United States by name, and they are the ones, of course, carrying out this blockade. What is the message of the Human Rights Office to the Trump administration about that specifically? And could you give us more metrics? You mentioned 80%, for example, in some of the data, you mentioned 80% of water pumping equipment. What are the concrete impacts of this blockade specifically? If you have any numbers on that, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie. I did mention U.S. by name, apologies if you didn't understand, in my first sentence, and I'm going to read again for you to clarify what I said. We are extremely worried about Cuba's deepening socioeconomic crisis amid a decades-long financial trade embargo, extreme weather events, and the recent U.S. measures restricting oil shipments. So what we are asking, as I mentioned at the end, is to lift all sectorial sanctions because they have a really broad impact and are impacting human rights of and the daily life of Cubans. For example, like what you were asking about the electricity. The country's electricity system relies almost entirely on thermoelectric plants, and that requires oil and diesel. If they don't have diesel, they cannot produce electricity. There are, for example, 3,000, almost 200 hemodialysis patients that they're not going to get the treatment they need if they don't have electricity. There might be setbacks in health indications. If the cold chain is broken, there's no deliveries of vaccines. And if there's no vaccines, outbreaks of diseases can appear. You might recall that a few months ago, there were already some communicable diseases outbreaks in the island. If there's no water, proper water to assist, if there's no vaccines to protect people, this disease can spread rapidly. There's in Cuba, there's food baskets, a system of rations. These rations have been already cut, but if there's not fuel to put in the trucks to be able to distribute food, people might not get food, might not be able to eat. So there's no drinkable water, there's no food, there's no medicines. So the whole system of protecting the population, protecting their rights to food, to health, to water, it's dismantled. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A question from Paula of Geneva Solutions. Paula.
Yes. Hi, Marta. How are you? Wanted to ask you a little bit about, actually, it's more for other agencies eventually. The situation has been pretty complicated in Cuba now for some years. And I'm just wondering who amongst the agencies or other organizations are on the ground, and whether there has been any communication with the U.S. to try to get some aid into the country. I know that Mexico had delivered some assistance this week. Is that assistance just coming from the Mexican government, or are there talks with Mexico or other countries to try to help channel some assistance into the country?
Thank you, Paula. What I can say to you, we don't have a presence in the country, but we have a good relationship with the Cuban authorities, and we are focusing, of course, on human rights, and we have organized a human rights agenda with them, and we offer some technical assistance. But as a matter of fact, a colleague was in Cuba recently in a mission, in a workshop on racial discrimination, and she could see by herself the reality of the impact of the sectorial sanctions and, of course, the 64 years blockade in the island. Thank you.
Thank you, Marta. And we do have colleagues online from the humanitarian agencies. If should you have anything to add, please just put your hand up. Otherwise, what I suggest is maybe we could double back after this briefing to see if we have anything to add in terms of UN presence. I don't have that off the top of my head, but we have, I think, a small presence in the country, but we'll have to get back to you on that, Paola. Yeah, please, go ahead, Marta.
Yes, sorry, and I have something else to add on that, waiting for colleagues. As you know as well, the hurricane Melissa struck the island in October, devastating it, and colleagues on the ground, humanitarian colleagues are on the ground, but are they are as well suffering. We have got information from the UN city, from the UN Resident Coordination Office in Cuba, that the humanitarian activities are as well affected by the shortage of fuel, and the UN system itself doesn't have different access or preferred access. So the UN activities on the ground are already affected, and we are not able to deliver the assistance people need.
Absolutely. We'll follow up with more details in terms of what we're able to do on the ground with the various agencies there. Thank you very much, Marta. We still have some questions for you. Moussa Al-Mayadeen.
Merci beaucoup. Bonjour, Martha. Est-ce que on est donc à Cuba, on est en train de voir un système de sanctions qui se met en place, comme on a vu auparavant, donc des sanctions contre d'autres pays comme la Syrie auparavant, l'Iran, Mozambique et autres. Est-ce que on est devant un système de sanctions unilatéral de la part de des États-Unis? Et hier, on a vu un statement de plusieurs experts des Nations Unies. Il parlait de but politique de ces genres de mesures prises par les États-Unis. Est-ce que c'est votre vision aussi? Merci beaucoup.
Bonjour, Moussa. Je vais répondre en anglais. So yes, we saw what you were referring, and what we say in this case, but again, in any other case where sectorial sanctions are imposed, we always say that those sectoral sanctions affect the most vulnerable, affect the people are not effective, and they don't comply with the UN charters and international law, because the sanctions should be imposed by the Security Council, not by a country. And in this case, again, these sanctions are incompatible with the U.S. obligations. All states are obliged to protect human rights everywhere. So imposing these sanctions are the only thing that is doing it's not being able to respect human rights of Cubans. Thank you.
Thank you once again. Isabel, Spanish news agency, EFE.
Yes. Hola, Marta. ¿Qué tal? I would like to know if everything that you have described before represents a collective punishment for the entire population in Cuba in order to achieve this political objective that you also mentioned. And connected to this, if we can specifically state that the U.S. is violating the international humanitarian law. Thank you.
As I said, the measures need to comply with the UN Charter and international law, and it does not appear that this is the case. But let me as well read to you, every year the SG, the Secretary General, issues a report on the impact of the embargo on Cuba that could be as well be applied to the case of the unilateral sanctions. And what the HC, the High Commissioner, noted was that coupled with the cumulative effect of more than 60 years of other sanctioning measures imposed under the embargo and other economic factors continue to have a serious impact on Cuba's ability to fulfill its human rights obligations. So let me be clear, there's as well an obligation by Cuba to protect their citizens, But the sanctions imposed on Cuba as well undermine the capacity of Cuba or fulfilling its obligations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as you just heard, of course, you know that the UN General Assembly has year after year called for an end to the U.S. embargo on Cuba, and the SG, for his part, has urged all parties to engage constructively in a spirit of dialogue and, of course, as just heard, respect for international law. This is well recorded for more than six decades now, in fact. Emma.
It's not on Cuba. It's a more general question for Marta, if I may.
Let me just check. There are no further questions before we take another subject. Okay, we'll allow it then. In that case, Emma, on another subject.
Thank you. Hi, Marta. It's whether OHCHR has any formal reaction to the criticism of the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, from European governments, which she says is based on words that she never uttered, criticism of Israel, namely. Do you have any statement of support for her, or what is your reaction to this trend? Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. On what you referred, the SR remarks at the Al Jazeera Forum, the SR herself have publicly clarified that her remarks were describing broader systematic threats to ensuring the protection of people from repression, apartheid, and genocide. She did not characterize any state as an enemy of humanity. I quote, I invite you all to go and see her remarks or read them. And let me add that we are very worried, we are concerned that UN officials, independent experts, and judicial officials are increasingly subjected to personal attacks, threats, and disinformation that distracts from the serious human rights issues. So let me come back to the issue. Gaza, let me give you the numbers, the figures we have from on the ground. Israeli military operations, including airstrikes, shelling, and gunfire, continue to claim Palestinians' lives despite the so-called ceasefire announced last October. 591 Palestinians were killed in Israeli military operations as of 11 February, since the ceasefire was announced. These killings show that Israel continues to disregard its obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law. West Bank, we issued a press release briefing note last week, or this week actually, on Tuesday, no? How Israel is not fulfilling its obligation as an occupied power, and how its policies are threatening and undermining the two-state solution. This is what we should be talking about, the reality on the ground, human rights of the Palestinians and every other person in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marta. Okay, I think that's it for you, Marta. Thank you so much. Do you have something to add?
Yes? Yeah, go ahead. I wanted to tell you, confirm that the High Commissioner did meet with the Prime Minister, and we did issue a tweet, so I can share it with you when I'm down from the podium.
Why you didn't inform us?
We did issue a press release.
Why didn't you inform us by this visit?
We don't inform in advance of all the meetings and all the visits. Like, it's up to the mission, to the country, to share this information if they want. We, as a matter of policy, we don't inform upfront of the High Commissioner agenda. But usually when he meets with high-ranking officials, presidents, prime ministers, we issue a tweet. I'm happy to share it with you.
Yeah, I mean, supporting that comment, we do the same. I mean, that's at the discretion of the receiving countries often. if they, for sometimes for security reasons, for we don't always publicize agendas. Secretary General, for example, it's the same. We do our best to share readouts with you in a timely manner. If there is a photo opportunity or something that we can share before, and we do that. But we are always very mindful of the wishes of the those that we are meeting with our UN officials. So in terms of a tweet, I take John's point earlier, we'll do our best to inform you in a timely and efficient manner. And of course, this is something that has been raised before. So thank you. And thank you very much, Marta. Okay, moving on. Back to the other side of the planet, and thank you very much, Ms. Goossens. Tanya Goossens is World Food Program's Country Director for Madagascar, who's joining us from Antananarivo, who will speak to Cyclone Gezani. And thank you very much for your patience, and thank you for joining us here, Ms. Goossens. Over to you.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to comment on the situation here in Madagascar. So just in the space of 3 weeks, Madagascar has been hit by back-to-back cyclones. So right now, according to initial estimates, we have about 400,000 people that are facing acute needs because of these back-to-back shocks. First of all, we had, of course, Cyclone Fitia, which brought heavy rains and flooding. And then shortly after, we had Cyclone Gezani, which resulted in damages due to its very strong winds with gusts of up to 250 kilometers per hour. I've just come back from the cyclone hit Tamatave. So this is where Gezani made landfall Tuesday evening. Tamatave is Madagascar's second largest city, and the scale of the destruction is really overwhelming. I was on mission with the resident coordinator, with representatives from UNICEF and IOM, as well as a small group of key humanitarian donors to assess the situation. And we conducted also a site visit where IOM, UNICEF, and WFP are coordinating an initial response. In fact, the president of the Refondation de la République de Madagascar received the delegation accompanied by concerned ministers and also briefed us on the situation. The authorities have reported that 80% of the city has suffered damage. The city's running on roughly 5% electricity at the moment. There's no water. And in fact, one of WFP's warehouses and our office was also completely destroyed during the cyclone. As I mentioned, assessments are ongoing, but to date, authorities have reported in Tamatave 38 deaths, 374 people injured, and over 260,000 people that have been affected. When I mentioned the 400,000 earlier, that's, of course, considering also Cyclone Fitia that hit the northeast of the country end of January. Families have left their homes, and what we saw, many buildings, businesses, and schools, even the hospital, having suffered severe damages. During my visit, I saw families trying to recover the little that was left of their home. Many are spending actually the night in homes where the roofs have been torn off. And this at a time when already yesterday we experienced rain. Rain was incoming. There's uprooted trees and debris across the city. This is blocking streets, and fuel is also difficult to come by. With support from the UN Humanitarian Air Service, so UNHAS, operated by WFP, a multi-sectorial aerial assessment was conducted. This was facilitated by UNHAS, but then, of course, coordinated by OCHA with different actors. That also took place yesterday. It also took place following Cyclone Fitia earlier, a few weeks ago. And this has really allowed us to gather additional insights, of course, about the scale of the destruction, not just actually in this case Tamatave, but also the areas beyond Tamatave. And results of that will be available in the coming days, and will also, of course, inform the humanitarian response. UNHAS is also conducting at this moment special flights for humanitarian actors. The government has declared the situation as a state of national disaster and has actually also appealed for international aid. Of course, in addition to the urgent need for food, we are concerned about water, sanitation, and hygiene conditions, as a lack of clean water and damaged infrastructure raises the risk of disease outbreaks. There are also rising protection concerns for vulnerable groups, particularly for women, children, the elderly, and persons with disabilities. Ahead of Cyclone Gizani's landfall on Tuesday, WFP acted early. We had pre-arranged funding from the SURF mechanism and also Germany, and that was critical to allow us to act in anticipation of the shock. Together with the government and the Malagasy Red Cross, we are providing anticipatory cash assistance to 11,000 of the most vulnerable households, so that's roughly 50,000 people, to help them withstand the shock from this latest disaster. And this anticipatory actions for Cyclone was actually the first for the country. This early action allowed, of course, families to purchase some food and to protect essential assets and to better prepare before the storm struck. In the immediate aftermath, we are mobilizing our last food stocks, including fortified biscuits and rice, which we will distribute in close coordination with national disaster relief teams. And this rapid assistance will support 18,000 people following the two cyclones. We also have a 6x6 truck that is on its way to Tamataf today to further assist those areas that are difficult to reach. However, the needs that I certainly witnessed on the ground far exceed our current capacity. Beyond the anticipatory actions that I mentioned and the rapid responses planned, there is no funding currently available for cyclone response, and urgent donor support is essential to secure rapid delivery and bridge pipeline gaps in support of these people that are affected by cyclones. Of course, a cash-based response is critical because it can allow us to quickly assist at scale, also restoring purchasing power for affected households and stimulate local markets. Families are telling us that they have lost everything. Many are sheltering, as I mentioned, in damaged homes or temporary sites and uncertain about how they can access their next meal. This is not just an emergency response moment. We will need, of course, sustained support over the coming months to help people recover, to rebuild, and strengthen their resilience against further shocks. And in fact, we are at the start of the cyclone season. So we are also, of course, concerned that this is only just the beginning. And on top of this, this comes on top of an already very critical food security situation. Before the cyclones, latest IPC data demonstrate that 1.57 million people were food insecure across Madagascar, including 84,000 facing emergency levels of hunger. And that number is projected to rise to 1.8 million, given that we're also in the peak of the lean season here in Madagascar, and funding shortfalls remain, of course, alarming. Our overall emergency response, and by that I mean our lean season response, as well as cyclone response, faces a USD $18 million gap over the next 6 months. And these constraints have already forced us as WFP to reduce lean season assistance elsewhere in the country, particularly the south and southeast of the country, to just 10% of planned beneficiaries. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Tanya. And okay, well, let's see if we have questions for you. And of course, this is an immensely important appeal. And sadly, far too often, we're short of cash, and the needs are immense. So thank you very much for highlighting those. Let's see if we have questions in the room. Firstly, I don't see any online. No, I don't see any questions for you. So I think you were very, very comprehensive. And of course, we appreciate you briefing us, and we'll definitely share your notes with our journalists here and do our best to highlight this important and dire situation. So thank you very much, Tanya, for joining us from Antananarivo. And do join us anytime.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, moving slightly north. We have, Ricardo Pires of the UNICEF is here to introduce a guest who's joining us from Juba in South Sudan. So, Ricardo, over to you.
Thanks, Rolando. Hello, everyone. Good morning. Just to introduce our country representative, AI in South Sudan, Obia Acheng, who will be briefing on the dire situation of children amid violence escalation in parts of the country. Since late last year. Over to you, Obia, and thank you very much for the patience and for waiting.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Since late December 2025, a devastating escalation of violence has swept across South Sudan, that is in the northern and the central parts of South Sudan, specifically in the Jonglei state. It is estimated that at least 280,000 people have been displaced in Jonglei state alone. The majority are women and children. For some, unfortunately, this is not the first time that they've been displaced. It is the second time, and for some, it is actually the third time. It essentially means that the violence has led to a situation where children have no place to run or community members have no place to run. We believe that about 53% of those displaced are children, which is a high number. Most of the ones who fled, like I said, have fled for the second or third time. They fled with nothing. They are sleeping in displacement camps that have been left, that are far away from their homes where they used to be. And in the camps, they basically have services. And when I say camps, these are not like our usual organized camps. These are like more of informal settlements in remote locations. Just to reiterate again, this is an escalating crisis, and the impact of children is grave. We continue to see it every day. Unlike other countries where we have children who could dream of a future, in South Sudan, we are seeing more of killing and maiming of children, recruitment into armed groups, separation from their families. GBV is happening, and there is profound psychological distress that will mark these children for several years to come. The health system in the country is challenged. And that's because of the movements that they have and challenged because of the economic situations that they have. Whilst the conflict is exacerbating the health situation, we estimate, or it is reportedly that around 11 health facilities have been attacked and looted since the fighting escalated in January. Nutrition centers that were keeping children alive have been forced to close. This week, for example, in Bor Hospital, our team met a young mother just to relate the story to a person called Ahel Deng. She was breastfeeding her two-year-old son. She told us that when the fighting started, her family stayed at home for over a week. They kept cattle, they farmed, they sold crops, they had a life which they are living. Unfortunately, all that is gone. She fled into the thick bush with her child. When she finally reached Bor, she had no milk. She could not afford to buy anything. She was exhausted. She was in pain. And she was visibly in a state of shock. Ahel, though in a state of shock, she's one of the lucky ones to make it alive. She reached a hospital. Many have not reached the hospital. And in the locations where we are having this conflict, there have been reported outbreak of cholera since January. This has climbed to about 479 countrywide. And in Jonglei State, 125. With treatment centers that are overstretched and critically under-resourced, it is a challenge that they live with every day. We estimate that around 825,000 children across Jonglei, Unity, Eastern Equatoria are now at risk of acute malnutrition. And these are locations that they've been having acute malnutrition for several years. And here is a number that should keep all of us awake. A child with acute malnutrition without treatment, for me to underline, is 12 times more likely to lose his or her life. Pregnant and lactating mothers like Ahel are increasingly cut off from any maternal and newborn care. And the humanitarian infrastructure that could help these families is also under attack. On 3rd February, the MSF-supported hospital in Lankien was bombed, its warehouse and essential supplies completely destroyed. Across the conflict zone, humanitarian assets and supplies have been looted, such as vehicles, food, communication equipment. Access remains constrained. In non-government controlled areas, supplies or humanitarian assets. There have also been loss of lives from the humanitarian actors. Despite all this, UNICEF, other UN agencies, NGOs, both international and national, are committed to respond. We were one of the UN agencies to get supplies in after the violence renewed. Like I've indicated, this was in partnership with other UN agencies and NGOs. We reached Akobo for the first time and delivered about 2.5 metric tons of emergency health and nutrition supplies. We are responding to the cholera outbreak in Duke County. We are running primary healthcare, nutrition, water, sanitation, and child protection programs, both in Eastern Equatoria and Unity. And in Bor, UNICEF has supported nutrition centers that are treating children like Aheu's son, screening them, providing ready-to-use therapeutic food, and pulling them back from the edge. But these are isolated windows. They cannot match the scale of what is unfolding in the country. The solution is an immediate cessation of hostilities, and that is what UNICEF and other actors are asking for. Apart from the cessation of hostilities, we need rapid, unhindered humanitarian access across all affected areas. Hundreds of thousands of children are depending on the cessation of hostilities, and number two, provision of unhindered access. Mothers like Aheu are depending on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Achieng. Truly heartbreaking, the statistics you just shared with us. And thank you very much for the life-saving work you're doing at UNICEF in South Sudan. Let's see if there are any questions for you. No. I don't see that's the case, Mr. Achieng, but once again, it's immensely important that you connect with us, and we'll do everything we can to address this really difficult situation in the country. Thank you very much for the work that you're doing at UNICEF, and of course, should we have questions afterwards, we'll liaise with you and maybe Ricardo. We do have a colleague from WHO who wanted to add something, so let me just take that comment from Christian from WHO. If you can stay with us, Mr. Achieng.
Yeah, thank you very much, Roland, and thank you very much, colleagues from UNICEF. I do actually have a couple of points, as they appeared recently in a statement by our Director General on the attacks on healthcare in South Sudan. So across South Sudan, WHO documented at least 19 attacks on healthcare in 2025, resulting in deaths, injuries, destruction of critical infrastructure, and the fight of health workers from insecure areas, the flight, obviously. The consequences for civilians are immediate and severe, as we also heard from the UNICEF colleagues. Based on health facility catchment areas affected by the attacks, displacement and service suspension, an estimated 1.5 to 2 million people are currently facing reduced or no access to essential health services, particularly in Jonglei, Upper Nile, Unity, and parts of the Equatories. These disruptions affect the emergency and trauma care, maternal and newborn services, immunization and nutrition programs, treatment of cholera, measles, malaria, and other communicable diseases. Patients are abandoning treatment. Outreach services have stopped. Disease surveillance is weakening precisely when it is needed most. As of early February 2026, more than 365,000 people have been newly displaced, with over 280,000 in Jonglei State alone, many fleeing areas where health facilities have been attacked or rendered non-functional. These population movements are occurring alongside a rapidly worsening cholera outbreak, creating ideal conditions for cross-country and cross-border disease spread as they move along with the disease, knowing or not knowing that they're affected. Delayed detection of outbreaks, increased preventable deaths. In a highly interconnected region, this is not only a national crisis, it is a regional and global health security threat. Attacks on healthcare are serious violations of international humanitarian law. Medical personnel, facilities, and transport are protected under the Geneva Conventions and UN Security Council Resolution 2286. The repeated nature of these attacks reflects a dangerous erosion of respect for these norms and a climate of impunity that must be reversed. We call on all parties to the conflict to immediately cease attacks on healthcare and humanitarian operations, to guarantee safe, sustained access for health workers, patients, and supplies, and to respect international humanitarian law without exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christian. So, colleagues, I mean, these are multiple crises. You know, this is what we do at the United Nations. We put our lives on the line for to help others. And we've heard very pointedly from Christian and from Mr. Acheng, who's in Juba, the crises. We're dealing with malnutrition, cholera, 53% of children displaced, attacks on health workers, health facilities, horrible situation. So thank you very much for your attention to these issues, colleagues. And thank you very much, Mr. Acheng, and, of course, Christian, for highlighting this situation. We'll do what we can to generate some sort of humanitarian response. So thank you very much for joining us again, sir. And please feel free to do so in the future. I think that is it. No further questions, no questions on this situation, but we'll move on to just a few announcements before we wrap up this press briefing. To make sure you're aware of all the goings on, we have the Secretary General who's currently in Addis Ababa. He arrived there yesterday. Mr. Guterres is in Ethiopia, the Ethiopian capital, to take part in the 39th ordinary session of the African Union Summit. That's taking place tomorrow. Today, he's also taking part in the second Italy-Africa Summit, which is taking place on the sidelines of the African Union Summit. He is also taking the opportunity whilst in Addis to meet with several leaders. Several bilateral meetings are being scheduled, as I alluded to. We have readouts from the SG's meeting with the chairperson of the African Union Commission, President of Burundi, and the President of Ghana thus far, which we shared with you. And we will certainly, tomorrow the Secretary General is scheduled to do a press conference at 3 p.m. That is in Addis time. I believe it's 1 hour ahead. So we will certainly share those comments in the transcript with you thereafter. I also wanted to mention that yesterday we had a Security Council briefing on the situation in Yemen. We shared with you remarks from the special envoy of the Secretary General Hans Grunberg on the situation in Yemen, as well as from OCHA on behalf of Tom Fletcher. So those are obviously important reads for your attention. Today here in Geneva, we have two committees which are continuing its work. The Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, is reviewing today the report of Lesotho. And the Committee on the Economic, Social, Cultural Rights continues its session to next Tuesday, the 17th. It will review the report of Australia. I also have a note which you should have received in your inbox a short while ago from the Human Rights Council. The Human Rights Council's Advisory Committee will hold its 34th session starting this Monday, the 16th of February, throughout the week, 16th to 20 February. So the Human Rights Council's Advisory Committee is holding its annual session, and this is addressing many important issues, including artificial intelligence, neurotechnology, plastic pollution, and sea level rise, among other topics. So, very important meeting from the Human Rights Council's think tank. We issued a statement last night from the Secretary General on the appointment of the Independent International Scientific Panel on Artificial Intelligence, which was created by the General Assembly earlier. Now, there are 40 members of this newly established body, which has just been appointed. So the Secretary General issued a statement to that effect. And these are leading AI experts from across the globe who will be providing independent and impartial assessments of AI's opportunities, risks, and impacts, including on the global dialogue on AI governance. Now, he says in his statement, in a world where AI is racing ahead, this panel will provide what's been missing, rigorous, independent, scientific insight that enables all member states, regardless of their technological capacity, to engage on equal footing, end quote. Colleagues, today, or before I move to that, let me just mention that the Security Council is addressing the situation in Syria today, just to make sure you're aware, since this is an issue which, of course, has been raised here many times. The Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Claudia Cordone, will be briefing, as well as a representative of OCHA. So do watch that space. We will share with you any statements that come our way. And now, lastly, today is World Radio Day. 13 February, and this date marks the day in 1946 that UN Radio was established, shortly after the creation of the UN itself. Now, as you know, UN Radio has evolved into UN News, which is a multimedia platform, which is offering daily news and multimedia content in multiple languages. Now, UN News products are distributed by thousands of media partners, including more than 2,000 radio stations worldwide, which is immensely important, particularly for audiences in developing countries. So this year's World Radio Day focuses on artificial intelligence, and it's an opportunity to really talk about how, when used responsibly, AI helps broadcasters reach more listeners, build stronger connections, and put out great content in a timely manner. To a shout out to our colleagues at UN News, putting out immensely important news stories for your consumption. That's it for me. Any questions? No, I don't see that's the case. So I wish you a good afternoon, nice weekend, and see you here on Tuesday.